of the renormalization group, or rather consequences of the phenomenological theory which exists around the renormalization group. What we did was we thought about what happens when the lattice constant turns into some multiple of itself, when the functional of the spins, which gives the whose exponential, when summed, gives the free energy, turns into another functional of spin variables, which are each themselves functions of the sigmas. When, as we have organized the thing, the partition function remains invariant under the transformation, but the coupling constants turn into some function of the old coupling constants. And then we argued that this vector of coupling constants, K, at the critical point remains invariant. That's how the scaling works. And then we talked about a small deviation from the critical point. I talked about T as if it were a scalar quantity. It also, one can talk about it as a vector produced by all the couplings. At this point, of course, I'm talking about a scalar. The phase diagram has the property that the disordered region of the phase diagram goes into the disordered region, the ordered region goes into the ordered region. I'm now just repeating myself, and now we go after physical quantities. For example, the coherence length is some number times the lattice constant times the temperature minus times the deviation from criticality to some power. Because this goes to zero at the critical point, the coherence length goes to infinity. The two-dimensional Ising model has the power 1. The three-dimensional Ising model has some irrational value of the power 0.64 dot, 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 dot. Under the renormalization transformation, all the distances remain the same. It is only the physical distances remain the same. It's only the lattice constant which transforms, and that gives us the value of this physical quantity, nu, which describes the divergence in the coherence length, in terms of this mathematical object, x, which describes how the deviation from criticality behaves under the renormalization transformation. I got to roughly this point and then decided I didn't have enough time to finish up the slide, so instead I gave a discussion, waving my hands around. I'll finish up the slide now and then finish up the discussion for now of the renormalization group. The number of lattice sites, of course, is reduced. If we start out with the number of lattice sites is the volume of the system divided by the lattice constant to the power d, the new number of lattice sites is reduced by a factor of a prime over a raised to the dimensionality of the system. The free energy remains invariant, because the free energy is defined from the partition function. However, the free energy per lattice site, this small f, is not invariant because the number of lattice sites changes. In fact, the free energy is some non-singular stuff plus some number, which is the number of lattice sites, times some critical functionality, some critical function of the deviation from criticality. And then after a tiny bit of fussing, we see that this goes as, this has to go as the deviation to the power d times x, where x is what's defined here, and it is the thing which goes into the change in the number of lattice sites. That means the specific heat capacity, which is the second derivative of the free energy with respect to the temperature minus the critical temperature, or with respect to the coupling constant at criticality, goes as T to the dx minus 2. Second derivative gives us a minus 2. And hence, the form of the singularity is also determined by this quantity x. Once we know x, we know the form of the divergence in the specific heat. In particular, for the two-dimensional Ising model, we have x is nu is 1, and dx minus 2 is 0. That's not, the formula is written here, doesn't quite apply when this result is 0. You get instead the specific heat goes as the logarithm of temperature minus criticality, which minus the critical temperature, which is in fact the Onsager result. One can do many more roughly analogous calculations, all of which give essentially the correct answer for the behavior in the neighborhood of the critical point. Equivalently, one can do the same thing in field theory and get essentially the right behavior for a whole variety of physical quantities, going up from the smallest microscopic scale to the scale of the Pi meson or whatever, the scale of the Large Hadron Collider at which we observe things. Now, there is a way of describing this. You remember I described the one-dimensional Ising model by putting everything on a line. That line extended from zero coupling out to infinite coupling. And I said the one-dimensional Ising model would have a flow in which, as you did the renormalizations, everything would flow down to the weak coupling because all of the behavior of the system was at the largest scale equivalent to the weak coupling behavior. Here, the behavior is different. The deviation from criticality is some coefficient, a prime over a, to the power x times t. The a prime over a to the power x has x greater than 0, and t prime is bigger than t. If you start out near the critical point, but just below, in the next iteration, you're further away and further away and further, until after many iterations, you go down towards weak coupling, and the system behaves as if it is fully a weak coupling system. If you start out just above the critical point with the other sign of t, then the next iteration t is bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger until finally you approach the strong coupling fixed point at k equals infinity, and the system behaves like a strong coupling system. The flows then are shown by these arrows. The critical fixed point is here. The weak coupling fixed point is there. The strong coupling fixed point is there. If you start out below the critical fixed point, you flow down to weak coupling. If you start out above, you flow to strong coupling. These fixed points are called stable because you flow into them. This fixed point is said to be unstable, since if you start a little bit away from it, you move away. This is then the picture of what you have. You have a coupling constant, a critical value, 0, and infinite coupling. And that's the picture on which the flow diagram is produced. This flow diagram is a beautiful and insightful way of describing the system, a way which arrives because of the renormalization group. this kind of flow diagram is a major intellectual achievement. I'm about to say that I'm finished for now with renormalization group. I'm happy to answer questions if any have arisen. Okay, on to the next thing. Escape. Next thing is going to be on diffusion and hops. And back. Okay. Here is a list of slides as I produced them when I started writing up the lectures. However, I actually have only about half as many slides in this part of the lecture series than I show on that. I've eliminated almost all of the discussion of how you go from discrete to continuous. This is a fun topic in applied mathematics. It is, however, we just simply don't have the time for it, I think. In any case, we're going to be spending some time about talking about the dynamics of the system. Some of you have asked the question, where does the equilibrium statistical mechanics come from? How come I said we should work with e to the minus beta h, and that describes the equilibrium behavior of everything? Well, clearly the equilibrium behavior arises because of what happens if you wait a long enough time in any non-equilibrium system. It is then a consequence of dynamics and the time going to infinity, or it's supposed to be. We'll find that this consequence is a sort of non-trivial, that the logic which leads to it is not in a direct and easy logic. But we're going to start out from something which is relatively simple and straightforward. We're going to start out from a particle in a crystal which hops from place to place. I want you to imagine once more a crystal with represented by a bunch of lattice sites. I want you to imagine that we add a particle to that crystal and it lands on near one of those lattice sites. It is bound to one of those atoms for a while and then hops over to a neighboring site. And it hangs around there for a while and hops to a neighboring site again. This hopping motion is what we're going to describe in this section of the lecture notes, of the lecture. So we're going to do hopping on a lattice. And in fact, we're going to do hopping not on a three-dimensional or four-dimensional or two-dimensional lattice, but only on a one-dimensional lattice because it's easy and I can draw the pictures immediately. And then we will talk after a bit about what happens in higher dimensions. So I can draw, as I have, a one-dimensional lattice, looks like that. And I have a particle here, which starts out at j equals 0. Here is j equals 1, j equals 2, and so forth. And I imagine that as time goes on, the particle hops from one place to another. As t goes into t plus tau, tau being an interval of time, the position of the particle, xj, goes into xj plus 1, which is the same as xj, except that it is one lattice site away. Sigma j plus 1 is just exactly what you think it is. It is plus or minus 1. Now, I'm using the indices here somewhat differently from the way that I have used them in the past. The subscript J refers to a time. This sigma J plus 1 is a jump at the time tau times J. Xj plus tau is equal to xj plus a sigma j, where sigma j is picked at random among the two possible nearest neighbor hops on the along the lattice. So sigma j is a random number, which is either plus or minus 1. We'll assume that we start at 0 and go through the mathematics of this. The mathematics is relatively simple. We'll represent this random walk by two integers. One integer is n, which is the position on the lattice. And the position we get to after capital M steps. So n is the sum from k equals 1 up to capital M of sigma k. N times a is going to be the physical position. M times tau is the physical time. And for calculational purposes, it's important to notice that if we start out at k equals 0 and m equals 0, then n will be even if m is even and odd if m is odd. We have to keep track of this in some detailed calculations. I think the calculations will actually do a slightly less detailed, and we probably won't have to keep track. In fact, I'm going to go through this rather rapidly because it is not so hard. And we have the theorems in front of us to make it work. What's the average of x? Well, x comes from m steps, and those steps are random in plus or minus a. The average of x is going to be 0, since the average of x is the average of the sum from j equals 1 to m of sigma j, and sigma j averages to 0. X squared, however, is not 0. X squared is, on the average, the sum. This is just a nice way of writing x squared. A squared times sigma j times sigma k. We're calculating an average, so we put the expectation value signs around it. Sigma j and sigma k are uncorrelated. If j is going to be different from k, so we only have to worry about the terms in which j equals k. This whole thing is then proportional to what is called the delta symbol. Delta jk is 1 if j equals k and 0 otherwise. And since sigma squared is plus 1, the coefficient of proportionality is 1. And we get the average of x squared is a lattice constant squared times m. Our statement is the same that the statement is a zero-field uncoupling Ising system. The magnetization is proportional to the number of spins, but the typical magnetization is only proportional to the square. The squared magnetization is proportional to the number of spins, but the typical magnetization is only proportional to the square root of that number. That is, the root mean square value of x is a times the square root of m. The square root of m for large m is a number much smaller than m. Yes, please.
If you have like a charged particle walking in an electric field, like a charged particle in some water, let's say, would you have a correlation between sigma j and sigma k?
Yes. That is, I can easily imagine, say, the sigma j is equal to plus 1 with probability p, and minus 1 with probability 1 minus p, and have p bigger than 1/2, and then I would have a net tendency to move in the plus x direction. Then the average of x squared would be proportional to p times 1 plus 1 minus p times minus 1 times m. The average, I'm not going to do it in my head, obviously. The average of x squared will be, in fact, proportional to m times 1 minus times 2p minus 1. Yes. Squared. Okay, I did it in my head. Now you're going to have to check and see whether I got the right answer. But in any case, it's m squared that it's proportional to, and this then grows as m squared. However, if p is 1/2, the average of x squared only grows proportional to m. So. And that proportionality to m means that things grow very slowly. In fact, I have something on the next slide which talks about that, I think. No, I don't. I left that out. Okay, let me tell you what I mean by growing very slowly. Let's imagine that A is 10 to the minus 10 centimeters. That's a typical distance in a real system. Let's imagine that I go through M, which is 10 to the 10 steps. Then the total distance over which I go, up and back and up and back and up and back, if I had a pedometer on me and I calculated the total distance in which I went, I would go 1 centimeter, which is a reasonable distance. However, the average, the root mean square average of m, root mean square average of the distance to which I go, is proportional to m times a, and that is square root of m times a, and that's 10 to the 5 times a, and that's 10 to the minus 5 centimeters, a very small distance indeed. So this random walk takes me over very small distances, but I go up and back a lot.
But the fact that if you have a sort of like biased probability to jump to left and right, which I guess is how you model like a field, then you get a proportional, you get the square deviation proportion to m squared. So that's like a velocity now, right? Because the mean.
Yep.
Okay. So is 2p minus 1 pretty much the velocity then?
Pretty much.
Okay.
So we have, we move over large net distances if we have an electric field on us.
Right.
And we'll move over much smaller net distances if we don't have an electric field. And that's the nature of diffusive motion.
Okay.
Diffusive motion is without an electric field, and we move over small net distances. Okay. Now, I don't want to make a big song and dance out of this, so I'm going to talk about the probability that x after time t, that is after m steps, m being t being m times tau, has the value x, where x is the physical distance over which I move. Now, I know something about all of this.
from the last slide, I know that the average of x squared is m times a squared. And I know that x is the sum of many different random variables. Therefore, by the theorem, by the central limit theorem, such a sum is a Gaussian random variable. I therefore know the probability distribution of x. I know that the probability that x will turn out to have the value small x is proportional to an exponential of e to the minus x squared. And by converting this into physical units, that is, I have it mostly converted. This is mostly physical distance. But m is the time that we're talking about divided by tau times a squared. This is the variance in x. I then know all there is to know about the probability distribution. It is Gaussian. It's proportional to e to the minus x squared with this variance. And this gives the normalization of that Gaussian. That's everything there is to say. If I wanted to calculate further averages of x of t, I would notice that e to the iq x of t is this exponential of a square of q, and that I could generate any average I want from differentiating this. We're done with the properties of a single random variable. Higher dimensions. As you can see, I'm going rather rapidly. I do the same thing on a lattice in d dimensions, a simple cubic lattice in d dimensions. Here's a picture of a simple cubic lattice in d dimensions, which I, of course, got out of Google Images like anybody else gets pictures out of Google Images. I didn't entirely trust myself to draw a decent cube in a short period of time. The lattice provides a simplicity and control not available in a continuum system. There's no ambiguity, as there is an ambiguity in field theory about how things very close to one another should be taken care of. We're either at the same point or different points. I'm now going to talk about a random walk in a d-dimensional space. I'm going to have a lattice in which x is a lattice constant called a times a bunch of integers. That's this lattice that I've drawn here. And so a typical value of position is a times 1 and 3 and minus 1 and a whole bunch of things. And in fact, I'm going to normalize everything so it's all divided by 2. That's just convenient for me. If all the hopping occurs from one site to a nearest neighbor site, the hops are through one of two d vectors in the form a times m1 plus m2, m3 divided by 2, where the m's are integers. In fact, this picture and this doesn't correspond to one another. The picture is this cubic thing drawn head on. This thing, because of the factor of 2, is this thing twisted over and viewed from one corner, but it's all the same. So C naught is A times M, where each of the M's have magnitude M, magnitude 1, but different signs. For example, one step would be the A times 1 times minus 1 by minus 1. What this is now is the direct product of the different one-dimensional random walks. That is, in each one of these things is a random walk in its variable m, and then altogether it is a random walk in all the m's, so that we can in fact analyze this problem by simply saying that it is the problem of one-dimensional random walk done d times over again, with d as the dimension of the system. We get pictures like this, again copied from Google, and we get an analysis like this, in which the product, the probability that I will, in this d-dimensional system, have a displacement A times N in the time M times tau is going to be the direct product of the one-dimensional probability distributions. The one-dimensional probability distributions is each of the form of e to the minus x squared. A product of e to the minus x squared is also e to the minus x squared, with x being now the sum of the different components, until we get down to this answer. The probability that we go through a distance, through an interval time of time t, a distance r, is of the form of a Gaussian, where this guy is r squared, x squared plus y squared plus z squared plus however many components we have. And this is now the full answer to the d-dimensional random walk problem. I did it quick because it's easy. However, I would be happy to answer questions and do anything you want slow.
Can you explain why there's the factor of 2 in the vectors for the displacement and in the lattice heights, and why the lattice heights have to be given by all even or all odd numbers?
Yeah. Okay. Let's go back to the one dimension. Can I have this light off, please? Light off, please. Thank you. M equals 0. X is 0. That's good. Okay. I go through either plus 1 or minus 1 times A. And so M equals 1, I'm there. At M equals 2, I have X is plus or minus A. Plus or minus A, this is a different plus or minus, which is then either minus 2A, 0, or 2A. No one, minus 1A, no plus 1A, all even numbers. All odd numbers at odd steps, even numbers at even steps. I didn't like this. This gives me a pain in the neck in counting. So when I did d dimensions, I turned everything over through 45 degrees. So this was no longer true. And in d dimensions, I'll draw it in two dimensions. In two dimensions, what I said was that my lattice goes like this. And I'm here, and there, and there. And I have a much smoother description of what's going on. Yes?
So technically, we're not moving on a square, on a hypercubic lattice, but on along
We're moving in one directions on the hypercubic lattice.
Yeah, so each point of the lattice has two n neighbors, two to the n neighbors instead of two n.
Correct. That's so that when I could do, as you will see when you figure out what's in the notes, I could then do the d-dimensional problem as a direct product of the one-dimensional problems without worrying about evens and odds. Okay, so this is all trivial. This one-dimensional random walk is a trivial business, but what I'm going to be saying now is somewhat less trivial. What I want to do is describe this in terms of a diffusion process. We're going to start out by talking about, as we just did, a probability at the space-time point RT of having a particle present. And I'm going to be talking about the time derivative of that probability. I'm going to talk about it in two different ways. This is a continuum way, and this is a discrete way. In this continuum way, you know what is going on. Because we have a conservation law on the number of particles, in fact, there is just one particle, the probability density, rho of R and C, obeys a conservation equation, d rho dt plus div dot j equals zero. This conservation equation is familiar. I mentioned it once before. We talked about it once before. It is just the conservation of charge as it appears in electrostatics, electrodynamics. In discrete form, it is not more complicated. First, anybody want to say something about this, a question about this? This is,
so it should be rather familiar to you. Probability. Did something bad. Nope, didn't do something bad. Integral dr of rho of r and c equals 1 for all c. That's what's being considered.
The discrete version of this is in some sense even easier. I'm going to do it in one dimension again.
Now you all will have to keep your wits about you, because although it is relatively easy, it is unfamiliar, I suspect, so here we have a lattice described by n equals 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, etc. We have time equal m times tau. And we have exactly the same process that we talked about before. A guy perhaps sits here and in the time interval jumps to there or there. And we want the discrete version of this conservation law. So we ask the question, how does the probability for observing a particle at site n vary in time? And that question is, how does rho at time m plus 1 differ from rho at time m? And we'll look specifically at the point n, which is this point right here. Well, the answer to that is very simple. We have jumps from one lattice site to another. These jumps are represented by currents along the lattice. There's a current coming into this site from the left. This current is called I, and we label it by a site halfway in between the two lattice sites. So we say this thing is added to by the fact that there's a current at n plus 1/2 and time m. And I better get my convention right. And then there is a current which goes at this thing. That current going out like that subtracts from this density and is I. Sorry. Of n plus 1/2 at time m. There's a current coming in from here, that's n minus 1/2, and a current going out from there, it's n plus 1/2. The sign of the current has a convention to it. We say the currents going in that direction are positive currents. This formula is sort of obvious. However, as I said, you have to keep your wits about you. Okay, we have a discrete time coordinate m and a discrete space coordinate n. I'm going to assume that the initial probabilities are smooth, that is, smooth enough so that I can think of rho n m as a kind of continuum thing. And I can replace differences by derivatives. Question? Yes, good. Okay. I have a friend who stands at this point. That friend measures the amount of hopping that goes past him. I have another friend standing there who measures the amount of hopping that goes past. A hop going this way is a plus 1. A hop going the other way is a minus 1. My friend keeps track, and by keeping track of adding the plus 1s and minus 1s, measures the total current that is going through that point.
So what if he's done at the node?
I'm sorry, I couldn't understand the question.
What if, would be a case if the person stands at the lattice point?
Okay. Let me be somewhat more precise. Let me be somewhat more precise. Imagine that at time t is equal to 0, tau, 2 tau, 3 tau, I have particles sitting there. At time t is equal to 1/2 tau, 3/2 tau, 5/2 tau, etc., those particles jump from one place to another. My friend who sits halfway in between measures the jumps. My friend who sits on the lattice constant, sits at the lattice points, measures what happens at these even times and measures what's present there. So I have the two friends doing two different kinds of measurements. One friend is sitting halfway in between and measures what's coming by. The other friend is sitting on the lattice constant, sitting at the lattice site and measures what's there. I think I've now made it perfectly precise. Now, the only thing that I'm going to do to from here on is assume that this function I is sufficiently smooth so that I can replace this difference by a derivative, and this difference by a derivative, smooth in time, m, smooth in space, n. And then I get to an equation in which this thing Sign. I'm having trouble with signs. Let me get myself.
The first, the equation that you've written, the bottom, that should be minus, because n minus 1.
That's where I'm having my troubles. That's the wrong sign. I got a friend here. Thank you, friend. Okay. So let me take this equation and do the work on the blackboard rather than doing the work on the slide, because I know what the right answer is, and I didn't come up with the right answer on the slide. So what did I do with this? There's the eraser. Thank you. This is just a definition in rho n m plus 1 minus rho n m is equal to I n minus 1/2 m minus I n plus 1/2 m. M plus 1 m. Since this guy is bigger than that, this is the derivative of rho n m with respect to m if this is sufficiently smoothly varying. Equals. If this is sufficiently smoothly varying, n plus 1/2 minus n minus 1/2, this has a minus sign, is the derivative of I with respect to n of n m n. With a minus sign, this moves over to the other side of the equation, and that plus sign should be a minus sign in order to correspond exactly to that up there. Okay? Thank you once again. Okay. So we end up with d rho dm plus di dn equals 0. That does not give us an equation for what is going on. That doesn't tell us what's happening. We need one more equation. We need to be able to figure out what the current is. And since I have incontinently erased, I will put back my lattice. Here is N. Here is the place where the currents are. And now we can say, what happens to the current? How can we calculate the current at N plus 1/2 and M? Well, the current occurs because a particle jumps from here to there, or a particle jumps from there to there. That occurring because of that, the probability that a particle will jump from here to there, a particle will jump forward onto spot N, is rho nm. Bigger. N plus minus 1/2. Where do I actually do the calculation on the board? N plus 1/2. Here, in between. Current at N plus 1/2 occurs because a particle jumps from the site NM, this site here. The particle could jump with probability 50% that way and probability 50% that way. That's that factor of 2. Only if the particle jumps forward do we get a current passing through there. That's this term. However, we also can get a current from the next site on, right here. That current goes in the opposite direction and has a minus sign. So it's the difference between the rows of these two sites divided by 2. And by the magic of differentiation, inm is minus, with now the correct sign, d rho nm dn. This thing is called a constitutive equation. It expresses the current in terms of the basic quantities in the thing. In this case, there's only one basic quantity, rho, and this gives the current in terms of rho. You know at least one more constitutive equation. At least one more constitutive equation has been talked about in this last bunch of time. The stress tensor, Tij. I said that this was delta Ij times the pressure plus Vi Vj times the density. And then you heard something about the shear viscosity called eta. That is a term in the stress tensor which is proportional to Vi dxj plus dvj dxi, I believe with a minus 2 div dot v in it. I won't guarantee that too. This thing is the stress tensor, and I won't guarantee that sign either. This is another constitutive equation. It gives the it defines the viscosity in terms of the stress tensor, or tells you how the stress tensor depends on the viscosity. All the transport coefficients, the thermal conductivity, the electrical conductivity, anything else that you think of as a transport coefficient is defined in this fashion. So here is a constitutive equation in terms of discrete stuff. You put this constitutive equation together with the last slide stuff, which gives the d rho m dm minus di and m dn equals 0. This is the right result. You put this together with that, and you end up with an equation which looks like the following. So you put this together with that. You end up replacing the derivative of I. You replace I by a derivative. I appeared itself in terms of a derivative, and you end up with the equation. The time derivative of the density is proportional with a constant of proportionality 1/2. The second space derivative of the density. And when you put that back in dimensional variables, you end up with what is called the diffusion equation. D rho dt is some number, lambda. This lambda is given dimensional form by the lattice constant in tau, times the second derivative of rho with respect to x squared. Or in d dimensions, d rho dt is lambda times del squared rho. Now, why am I insisting on this? Well, OK, this is what happens in higher dimension. I just told you that. This is one of several equations describing the slow transport of physical quantities from one part of the system to another. Whenever there is a slow variation in space, a conservation law demands that there also be slow variation in time. That is, the conservation law is of the form the derivative of the conserved quantity with respect to time is equal to the divergence of a current for that conserved quantity. Whenever you have slow variation in space, that is, this derivative is small, then you have to have slow variation in time. Slow variation in time is important in particle physics because it's an indication of small masses, and small masses are important because that's the physical thing. We work at short distance scales to define the theory and long distance scales to observe it. And we want masses appropriate for the long distance scale. This argument, which I went through with the conservation law, was gone through in more detail and in richer form by Jeffrey Goldstone of MIT and my Chicago colleague, Yoshiro Nambu. Nambu is one of the people who defined how particle physics and condensed matter physics fit together. One thing that you get out of it in the example that I've just been talking about, is the diffusion equation. Now, I better tell you about a diffusion equation, because a diffusion equation has properties that are somewhat different from the equations that you're used to playing with in your undergraduate days. For example, you played with an equation in your undergraduate days for the propagation of light. The time derivative of something minus c squared times the x derivative of that thing describes the waves of propagation of light. You have to imagine the c squared in there because I didn't put it in, and gives you a solution of the form f of xt is g of x minus ct, that is light going that way, plus another function h of x plus ct of light going that way. This solution has the property that it could be equally well used to propagate forward in time and propagate backward in time. There is nothing different about forward and backward. And as you know, in classical mechanics, there's nothing different about forward and backward in time. You go forward in time with one sign of momenta, and you change the momenta, and the equations will describe to you what happens at earlier times. The diffusion equation is not like that. The diffusion equation does not allow you to go backward in time in any reasonable fashion. Let me describe to you how come. Diffusion equation is time derivative of rho is equal to lambda times second derivative with respect to x of rho. I can solve that equation formally by writing rho x t equals 0 as an integral dk. As you know, people reflexively put two pi's in when they do Fourier transforms. E to the I k x times some function which I call rho of k and 0. It should be rho, which I call g of k. This is the initial condition for that equation, and then as you can see by substitution, rho of x and t is the integral dk over 2 pi with the initial data given by g of k and e to the I k x and e to the minus lambda k squared t. And I better look at the slide. That's fine. Substitute in this thing into that equation, and you will find that it is an exact solution. Times. So imagine that you have some initial physical situation. You calculate g of k from that, and you use that to calculate this result. You now go forward in time, and in fact, everything looks wonderful. This exponential cuts off the large k behavior. The large k behavior is the very rapid wiggles, which you probably can't measure very accurately. And very small, very rapid wiggles, you certainly can't measure very accurately. But this is cut off by this term, and you don't see it in the solution. Now you imagine going backward in time. You imagine t less than 0. every blessed little bit of wiggle is exponentially magnified by this term. If I have at a very, very short wavelengths, very small distances, extremely small wiggles, those extremely small wiggles become extremely large terms if I am doing any t less than zero. The equation doesn't make sense for going backward in time. It is crazy. It is useless. It is not sensible. Going backwards in time is said to be a problem which is ill-defined in the sense of Hadamard, if you're in the right math community. You're not used to the idea, I suspect, that some equations don't have solutions in some domains. Every equation you work with, the Schrodinger equation, the equations of electricity and magnetism, and all of those equations have decent solutions, whether you go forward or backward in time. The diffusion equation works to predict the future. It loses information about the past, and you cannot extrapolate the diffusion equation to learn what the past was about. It doesn't work. Nature is like that. From what we know now, we cannot get an accurate picture of the past. We lose information about the past. Classical mechanics is not like that. Classical mechanics does not lose that information. This gives us a contradiction, in fact. We will, next few lectures, derive an equation due to Boltzmann called the Boltzmann equation, which loses information about the past. In fact, it is a pretty good description of what happens in gases. However, it does not agree with the notion that we get from classical mechanics that T goes into minus T, time reversal, is a trivial symmetry, giving us just simple stuff that doesn't change. This is an intellectual problem of some difficulty. And as an intellectual problem of some difficulty, we will have to struggle with it. And we won't fully answer it. In any case, the diffusion equation is different from the wave equation. The wave equation works globally, forward and backward in time. The diffusion equation does not work globally, does not enable you to go backwards in time. And that is an important distinction. We will see that distinction again when we look in the next lecture at the flow of momentum and the diffusion of momentum as it was described by Einstein. Questions or comments about this? Yes.
What about if you sort of like specify the source? I mean, we're using no source here to describe our diffusion, right? But we could put in the source. And then if you knew exactly what the source was.
If you know the past, you can predict it.
Right.
If you don't know the past, and you're told that the process going on is diffusion, you can't, from what's known now, figure out the past. If the process is going on is the propagation of waves, you can reconstruct the past from the waves that now exist pretty well. You don't lose information. You do not have information which is exponentially lost like this.
Yes, my question was, if you knew the past, can you reconstruct the past?
Mathematics is sort of like that. Mathematics has topologies in it. The other way of saying it is If you told me the past row of xt was an analytic function, that is, that there were no real, that it was infinitely smooth, I could then reconstruct the past. However, you're telling me that the row of x and t is analytic, is giving me a tremendous, huge amount of information, much more information than we usually have about the past.
Yeah, so just looking at a bunch of stuff, that's, if you, you don't know, because like even if there could have been a source at some time, but then that source disappeared, or...
I am reminded of that great philosopher from my day, Yogi Berra, who said, predicting is difficult, particularly of the future. Well, if Yogi had been struggling with diffusion equations, he would have said the opposite. Predicting is difficult, particularly of the past. Further questions? Yes, you seem to have a question.
Is this sort of a quick type of diffusion process is chaotic?
The motion that leads to the diffusion process is indeed chaotic. And we put it in as a random walk, if you recall. Chaotic, if you were told that the past is chaotic, you often, that information means that things are scrambled in the past and they're hard to reconstruct. Waves are, in that sense, not chaotic. Don't get scrambled and don't produce in equal measure to diffusion difficulties in extrapolating to the past. Yes?
Means anything, but what happens to the information? Where does it? Where? What process destroys information?
If that I means. Didn't understand a word or so. What happens to what?
To the information.
Ah.
Where do we lose it?
We lose it, of course. And
we have lost it because we have thrown it away. In the diffusion process, we say we have the sigma j's, and they're plus or minus one, and then we throw away all that information about the values of the sigma j. In this case, where we lose the information is absolutely clear. We have just thrown it away. In the physical system in which diffusion is occurring, we have lost the information because we haven't watched the step-by-step motion, and we cannot, from the information available to us, reconstruct that step-by-step motion. It is a random process. Despite the fact that we have lost something, it is not a big surprise. We decided to lose it right at the beginning of the calculation. Yes, please.
Is it compatible
with quantum mechanics?
Quantum mechanics has none of this. Quantum mechanics, the unitarity is the statement that you don't lose anything. On the other hand, quantum mechanics has a funny classical limit. We do not truly understand the classical limit of quantum mechanics. One thing that we do not understand is that in classical mechanics, but that's not quite right. What we say it's a threat. I have to think about this for a second. One thing that we can lose, which is lost in both quantum mechanics and in classical mechanics, is if these waves go out to infinity. Information which goes out to infinity is lost to us, or at least we pretend it is lost to us. And so even with wave motion, if things go out to infinity, we can lose stuff. quantum mechanics permits scatterings to go off to infinity and us to lose information. But unitarity is a statement, in some sense, that we don't lose information. The exact way in which information is lost in quantum mechanics and classical mechanics, but particularly in classical mechanics, is an extremely hard problem which is only partially understood. It has to do with chaos, and that it has to do with sensitive dependence on initial conditions, information flowing off to infinity, or information being lost somehow. But exactly how it occurs is only partially understood. I will give you an example in the next two lectures in which we have a perfectly beautiful equation due to Boltzmann for classical mechanical situations in which we lose information about the past. Yes?
So can you say that when we have a quantum statistical system, we never really know the exact Hamiltonian. We know some model Hamiltonian, and this Hamiltonian must equal some exact Hamiltonian plus some perturbation. And this perturbation will give us the non-unitary evolution. Which
that's certainly true, correct. In fact, if we do not have a full specification of the system, we have a loss of information. However, something happens in classical mechanics which it does not happen in quantum mechanics. In classical mechanics, we have what is called the butterfly effect, which is a popular way of saying the butterfly effect is that a butterfly who flaps her wings in South America the week before last may have caused the weather, may have affected the weather in a serious way here and now. That's because small effects within classical mechanics tend to have products which grow in time. That's another way of describing chaos. The effects grow and then they become complicated. Such a thing does not happen in quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanics does not have what is technically called positive Lyapunov. So I suspect you know what a positive Lyapunov is from the way you phrase your question. You don't, so I will tell you. It doesn't have small effects which tend to grow in time and produce big things after a long period of time. Quantum mechanics just has stuff which remains constant in time. It doesn't lose or gain information. Exactly how our world, which in some complicated, rich way, gains and loses information, can also be described by quantum mechanics. It's a big deal problem. And the problem shows up in a whole bunch of places. One of them is in black holes. We don't understand how we lose information, or if we lose information in black holes. But there are lots of other places. Since the problem is not fully understood, I can't describe it all to you. I will describe to you the beginnings of this problem by talking about the Boltzmann equation. I will describe to you the things we know about it, at least the things I know about it, in other contexts. But in the end, it will be for your generation and for later generations perhaps to get a more satisfactory answer to the questions you're asking.
So that would mean that in a macroscopic system, there is always non-unitary time evolution because we have increased energy.
However, I can show you equations which describe the world which have no increase of entropy. If I define the entropy as rho log rho, and do that quantum mechanically, and then define the equation of motion of rho, again quantum mechanically, rho being the quantum mechanical density matrix, and I'll start out in a pure state. I start out in a pure state. I stay in a pure state. No entropy is created.
But only if you know the kind of thing, exactly.
You can't, you can't tell me that what I know about the world determines what the world does. I won't accept that. One philosophical point of view, but it's not one that I hold to. My knowledge of the world has nothing to do with what the world does. The world does its own thing without asking me about it. So we got a problem. Okay, we also have one. Thank you.